All right. So this podcast is being filmed before a live studio audience.
That's the whole reason you wanted to do this, right?
Just it
so
is
you
totally.
Could say that.
Yeah. You know, my favorite TV show of all time, Cheers. Mm-hmm. I remember that from every beginning episode.
Love it.
Yeah.
Well then, I'm pulling up so that I can see it too here.
Okay. Hey, so Facebook, how's everybody doing tonight?
Hello.
We're trying something new. Be really mean and critical about how we're doing it. And, you know, how we're screwing everything up and everything we're doing wrong. Because this is kind of a, hey, let's see what happens kind of thing.
And watch us cry live on camera. but if you do want to chime in with questions, that's totally fine. We will stop for you. You know, provided that we're not too engrossed in what we already have to say.
I was like, I'll give a quick sneak peek into my day. I was like, I'm pretty sure our Facebook commenters can't make me cry, but that phosphate reactor sure could.
So what we're doing tonight, just for Facebook people, if there's anybody listening, is we are going to try live streaming recording one of our podcasts. Just to see how it goes.
Yeah, and we do have 9 people tuning in, so...
9? Oh, great. There's people watching already.
Let's see. How many of them are our moms? yeah, just so you know, you are the only one in the shot.
Oh, hi.
I was like, well, like, we have 3 moms, and then the rest of them are clearly grandparents, so...
Right. So wait, on Facebook, you can't see us at all? You just see Mara?
No, I'm saying
she's
the only
the
one
shot.
Of we've got 4 people that are also here in the room with us, and I was telling her the people that are in the audience that they are. So don't pick your nose or something.
Right. Yeah. All right, well, let's see how this goes.
Sure.
Cheers, everybody.
Cheers. Oh, Rob says hello.
Hey, Rob. Brackett?
Mm-hmm.
What's up, dude?
I'm sorry. Did you forget that was his first name?
But no, there's like, these are the Robs I know.
Oh, that's true. We do have a few of them.
I do have a number of them.
All right. Well, let's get going. What are we talking about today, you guys?
Well, you know, I got to introduce the podcast first.
Yes.
Right. Welcome to the latest podcast from the Watercolors Aquarium Gallery, brought to you from the Aquarium Rush Studios in downtown Grand Rapids, Michigan. Today, we are talking about the amazing, cool, confusing topic of apistos.
Yay!
Yay!
So I had to introduce it that way because I did actually do some research on this topic, but the Facebook people can see there's nothing written on my pad because what I was trying to do was decipher species and complexes to try and break it down a little bit to help understand them.
That made this really scary.
I was like, here, let me hold up mine. So just those are mine, by the way.
Okay, so I'm going to talk really quickly about what the heck is an apisto and why it's so confusing. And I'm going to do that before we really get into it. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So first, apisto is a dwarf cichlid from South America, exclusively. They're not found anywhere other than South America. They're pretty much only in the expanses of the Amazon River system. They pretty much are all microinvertebrate predators. Very little, they eat very little else other than if they can see some little critter swimming around, some little bug they're going to want to munch on it. So protein. They have great parental care 90% of the time. It's the female. There are some instances with some species, and by the way, I have no idea which ones, but some species where the males have a little bit more involvement, but typically the female raises the babies, the male protects the territory. That's kind of the breakdown. Mm-hmm. They're small, they're cool, the males are colorful, the females, many of them get some variation of cool yellow.
Yeah.
I almost like the females better in some species.
I kind of sort of agree with that. And really, with the captive bred variants now, it's hard to tell the difference.
Right.
It's like the female's just yellower.
Unless they're like in breeding dress. Right?
Yeah.
The yellow serves two purposes. One is to let the male know that it's time. And two is to have a beacon for the fry. When they're out foraging, they're foraging in some pretty... busy water, and so that bright yellow acts as an attractant to the fry. So hey, mom's over there. We gotta go keep up with mom.
I would imagine it's kind of like trying to keep your kids close at a huge amusement park or something like that. There's so many distractions. There's so much going on there.
Oh yeah, and there could be like 60 of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a tough job.
Right.
They are really good at it though.
Yeah. So we're talking about them today because they're a watercolor's favorite. I think it's safe to say that everybody here, studio audience included, thinks that pistos are sweet.
Yeah. To sort of tease an upcoming topic that we've been debating about, we've been talking about the difference between South American cichlids and the cichlids from Africa, not talking specifically about the Rift Lake cichlids. And that's a tough one to find an answer for. There's so many other medium to large cichlids. I'm like, the African one, whatever. It's really hard to find anything like an episto anywhere.
Right. The closest would be some of those Nanochroma species, I think.
Yeah, but it's just not quite the same.
Not quite the same, no.
No.
Nope. They're cool in their own right, and that's, teasing that topic a little further.
It's a conversation for another day. Right. but we get hung up on them.
So what is it about these crazy little fish that makes them so confusing and so hard to say, hey, this is a piece of Epistogramma nisoni, and this is, right? Why is it so confusing? What's the deal?
Well, let's start off with fun fact. The Amazon River Basin is a fairly new thing to the world.
And complex.
So one of the tricky things with epistos is they're all fairly young species, which means that their genetic differentiations are not very obvious. And what's really annoying is I don't want to get too much into how genetics works, but there are different scales of genetics where it's really easy to do genetics comparing to individual species and multiple species. So that means that think of a microscope where you're looking at something either 10 times magnification and 100 times magnification.
Right.
Now, the scale that you would really need to tell epistogrammas apart is about 20 times magnification. So the current tools we have are not quite fine-tuned to it. So it's confusing, but also we're always discovering more. So right now there's 70 plus described species and there's a backlog of about 400 more to go.
So anybody familiar with loricarids or corydoras, basically plecos and corycats, has started to get into the incredible amount of speciation that's happened in those groups of fish.
It's overwhelming. Those are genera, species and genera that are often only described by numbers. So,
And Corydoras that's just one genus.
Yeah.
Right. And with the loricarids, at least there's, it's the family Loricaridae and there's all these different genera, but with Corydoras, it's one genus.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so the reason for the extreme speciation we see in Corydoras and in Loricarid has everything to do with the geological boundaries and barriers that happen in the incredibly complex Amazon River system. Partially with the way it floods and drains, and partially with the way it's got these little bitty streams that go in all kinds of different places.
It's it's all connected, but also sort of not. Leads to so many cool things.
You've got fish that all three of those groups exercise some level of parental care or have small broodstock. They're not just broadcasting as many young as they can throughout the world, like tetras. Mm-hmm. Right? Cardinal tetras are found pretty much the same throughout the Amazon River system. And that has everything to do with their particular breeding strategy. Breeding strategies of epistos, where it's, I'm going to take care of this little group of phi in this little bitty space. And I'm not going to venture too far from that space.
Yeah, that's another thing that actually makes epistos genetically really hard to deal with. Mm-hmm. Because that parental care, that means that in streams, their genetics run on a spectrum. So you can go at one point in a stream and be like, okay, this is very definitely this. And then you'll keep going upstream. Let's say you go up 100 miles upstream and you're like, okay, this is very clearly something else. So where do you draw the line in that stream that they're different?
Because in between, there's some in between.
Yeah. Yep.
Who are those? Yeah. Are those sort of halfway between? Is it five different ones? Are they all the same? And who decides and why?
That's actually why I think Agazizii in particular, if you look at it, it's got 40 undescribed forms. Because it's Everyone's scared to draw that line.
Yeah. At some point, hopefully they're going to. But, you know, that's part of their fun, too, and that's part of the allure, because there are so many different ones.
So I have a question, and I don't know if you guys will have the answer to it, but do you know, like, what the sort of a typical geographical range of an Epistogramma species, or really any of those? Are we talking 10 miles? Are we talking 600 miles? Are we talking just this one mile of section?
I think,
like,
the
what is large?
That question is yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it depends on which stream you're dealing with.
Yeah. Like, Agassizes are spread out.
Mm-hmm.
But there's, like Charles said, 40 different populations. Are they going to genetically identify those as different species at some point? Depends on if you're a lumper or a splitter, right?
Yeah.
Whereas some of the other ones are going to be very specific to a little tributary of the Rio Negro and only found in that little 10-mile stretch of the Rio Negro. And that's it. That's the only place they're found.
Yeah, with like 400-plus species, making a generalization is not going
to
be easy.
It's just really hard to contextualize like a river system that's so large like that.
Right.
Like, in terms of like physically, how much space are we talking? Like 10% of the Amazon river system is some ridiculous number. So just trying to like get things to a level where we can really sort of understand what that is.
Yeah.
So let's try and go through, Charles, I know you took a bunch of notes based on taxonomy.
Yeah.
Right. So let's hear it. Let's get Charles's spiel on the attempt at trying to taxonomically classify epistos. And by the way, I'm going to just preface it with, you might be able to see, and you know, I could talk about across the board. I wrote epistos on our whiteboard as our plan for the day, and I wrote down four of the groups. There's different complexes within those groups.
Yep.
Except for pertensis. That's the only one in that group and in that complex. And I think in that clade, right? But then I put a bunch of question marks because that was confusing. So then I got out the what I consider one of the best books on dwarf cichlids of South America. This is Horst-Linke and Wolfgang Stack's Dwarf Cichlids of South America. And it has a lot of really good detailed information on species, but he groups the species one way. So then I got out the Aqualog South American Cichlids 2, which is really, you know, for a guy like me, it's perfect because there's lots of pictures and very little words. I like that. But they have the complex, some of the ones in where they put them in a complex or in a clade, this they put in a different clade. And so then I hopped that line and they did it in a different way. And that's when I that's when I took my notes and went, I don't need notes for this because
yeah.
Just see what Charles had to say.
So you're probably gonna find that my answers are gonna be a little bit different than maybe what you've read or what you see, and that's just based on I'm going off of the authors that I like their papers the best.
Perfect.
And that's really it. So I'm going to define a few things in taxonomy to make this easier to understand.
Excellent.
I'm going to start off with talking about differences between how species are identified. So you'll sometimes see, and the example I wrote down is Epistogramma agassizii ; Flamenco. That is not a subspecies, that is not a collection location, that is actually a color variety.
Perfect. So which we have color varieties.
Which is fun because collection locations are denoted the same way, which would be Epistogramma agassizii wherever it was collected in quotation marks.
Right.
And then this is the one where I think people really get tripped up on a lot, is you'll see Epistogramma CF quotation marks agassizii. And people will be like, oh, so it's a subspecies of an agassizii. No. So CF is, and I don't speak Latin, but it translates in Latin as near to or in comparison to.
Kind of like.
Yeah. So it's a way of taxonomists saying, we think it's closely related to this, but we haven't scientifically described it yet. So kind of agassizii like.
One of my favorite ones recently has been that, and it's the one that you really like, the Epistogramma agassizii, quote, Teffe Redback. So it's like, it's both a Cryptogramma agassizii. It's from Teffe and it's the Redback variant.
Yep.
Like, right. It's just, okay, so it's that one, I guess. Is there a Teffe that's not a Redback? And is it, it's, yeah, mind blowing. I don't know. It's pretty. It's really pretty.
So then I don't feel comfortable talking about any Epistogramma group as a clade because the genetic data is so janky right now.
Right.
To anyone listening that doesn't know the distinction there, a clade is defined as genetic, like, relatedness. It's a way of defining they have a common ancestor at some point.
And a complex is these seem like they're kind of similar to each other.
Based on morphology.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be talking about complexes, even though it's not normally what I like to do.
Right. It's the best we can do at this point.
And there are subcomplexes, which I'm not going to talk about at all because no thanks. But I will talk about that in Epistogramma, their genetics are so messy. There are two extra levels to talk about. So there's complexes. There are groups, which is complexes that are believed to be more closely related to each other than other complexes.
But still within the genus.
Yep. And then there are lineages, which is groups of groups that are more closely related to each other than
they
are to other groups.
Like, they probably came from the same fish.
Yep. Yep.
Okay.
So I'm going to start off with groups because this is the one that I was like, the genetic data on these groupings seems more solid than anything else because these are considered basal lineages, meaning that these are lineages that go back fairly far as Epistogrammas go. Given it's a clade that has only existed for a couple 10,000 years.
Yeah.
So the four big lineages are the Reagani lineage, the Pratensis lineage, and this is the one I'm going to destroy, a Diplotania lineage. Okay. And the Trifasciata lineage.
Hey, I did pretty good.
Yeah.
That seemed to be what these guys all agreed on as well. They didn't call them lineages, but they talked. I think they called them groups.
So,
yeah,
each lineage is different sizes.
Right.
The Reagani lineage has the Borrelii complex, the Reagani complex, the Hungsloy complex, and the McMasteri complex. The Pratensis lineage has the Wapisani, Staindacheri, Pratensis, and Aniridae. Diplotania is Diplotania.
That's the one that's all by itself.
Yep.
Okay, I thought it was Pratensis, but yeah.
Trifasciata is by far the most popular
the
one.
Rest
in
of them.
Yep, is the most popular one in the hobby. That would be the Nasianae, the Cacatoides, the Norbertari, Atahualpa, and Trifasciata and Agassizii complexes. Groups.
Yeah, so functionally, two complexes. I mean, the first one and the last one are the only ones that I recognize any of the names in.
In Ridae, we get that one we've seen. And I think Elizabethae is in one of those.
Elizabethae is in the, it's argued whether it's in the Trifasciata or Agassizii group.
Okay.
So, and basically, so it was the Trifasciata group and the Reagani group, right?
Yeah, it's got most of them with a couple of
outliers. At least morphologically or like in terms of their appearance, it's like the roundish ones and the mohawk ones.
that's not a bad description. Right? You know, we're talking about morphological differences, like, and I think you kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah, you summed it up a little bit there. I think that's good.
All right, so tune in next time for...
I figured it out, you guys. Right. We're just sort them into those.
Hey, see if there's a phone number in here and tell them.
I don't know why you guys are making this so complicated.
Alert the president.
Yeah, if only it were so easy.
Yeah. So then the Reagani group is one I think people will recognize pretty well because that's the one that Borrelia is in.
Right.
The undescribed species, Winkelfleck.
Yep.
Cruzi are all ones that I recognize.
Those we see.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yep. We see those pretty readily. And then the Cacatoides is, of course, the Cacatoides is the big one in that one. That is by far the most popular episto in the hobby.
Yeah, for sure.
McMasteri has Hungsloy, McMasteri, and the Viejita, which I actually get asked about a lot. And so here's... I have never seen one. Stop asking.
You've never seen a Viejita?
No. So what we have seen is there's a captive bred color variety of McMasteri that's bred to mimic the Viejita color. I have never seen a true Viejita.
The redneck McMasteri is often referred to as a Viejita, and it's not the actual fish. So we've had people come in and be like, but this is a McMasteri. Why are you calling it a Viejita? And it's because that's what it's called at this point.
Right.
People know it as that.
So just answering that question for anyone listening. the Nisenai is...
Nisenai.
That's probably Ben's favorite.
Yeah.
Because it's got the Banchai, Nisenai, and Panduro.
Panduro specifically being my favorite.
Yep. The Cacatoides, I've seen a couple of these names. I have never been asked about any of these other ones. But I will mention that the fun thing about Cacatoides is anything in that complex, they're prone to harem breeding.
Right.
So if you get one male that you just really like and you're like, can I just throw in like four females? Yes.
It also gives you the opportunity to keep more than just a pair, which is...
Yep.
Which is cool.
Yeah. More Opistos is better.
More Opistos is much better.
And then Trifasciata, I think that's the only one that I consistently see in that group is Trifasciata.
Who else is in that group?
I literally didn't write anything else down.
Oh.
Okay.
Because I was like, I don't recognize any of these other ones.
Right.
And then Agazizii, we get the Agazizii and then the Tifei. And I wrote down Elizabethae under the Gibbosens group. Yep.
That's the fun part about that when Charles goes, yep. Translation of Charles. That's Charles saying, yeah, because nobody really knows and that's the best we can do. And I agree with you. It doesn't make any sense. But that's what we got. So yep.
That's the best I got for you guys. All right, so
I had to pause to take a drink there.
No, you're good. I feel like I've talked about is the taxonomy as much as I want to in this. I really want to talk about how to take care of them and why they're cool and why you want them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really the main reason for having this talk is which ones do we get? Which ones can we take care of in which way and what are their similarities and differences?
Yeah, I'm definitely open to a freeform discussion where we're just like, oh, that one. Yeah, that one's cool. Yeah. That one's cool right. too. We really like that one.
It's about the best we can do.
Okay.
Because that's how we organize them. It's not taxonomic. It's just like our personal ranking systems. And there are no losers here.
So I put down in my notes, I think there is one most common mistake prospective Opisto keepers make. The most common mistake.
I'm intrigued.
You know, I get like bombarded with mistakes on such a regular basis.
I know. But there's one in particular that I'm like, that's the one that I just...
All right, so let's hear it. What is it?
Only getting one pair.
Hmm.
Because Opistos, a lot of the species don't form a true pair bond, but the two breeders need to trust each other because the female takes care of in most species that we deal with in the hobby, the female takes care of the fry and the male defends the territory so she doesn't have to worry about that.
Right.
That means they need to trust that the other one can do their job.
Right.
Otherwise they have problems. So that means your Opistos need to be compatible with each other. So if you just pick two random ones, I cannot tell you how many people have to exchange.
Oh, I see. Okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Okay.
Because my male doesn't like this female or my female doesn't like this male. And it's like, yeah, Opistos are like people. They don't always get along.
You're not saying let's pour four pairs of Opistos in a 10-gallon tank and let them duke it out. You're saying recognize that just because you buy a male and one female and one female doesn't mean you did it.
Yep. my personal strategy would I would replicate Ted Judy. He throws like six of them in a 40 breeder. When they figure out who they like, he pulls them out and then he puts them into tens.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we try to do that here a little
bit.
We
try.
Yeah.
Right? When somebody's coming in looking for a pair of Epistos, get the ones that are hanging out together.
Yep. We try our best. But yeah, there's only so much we can do.
Like, it might need to be a bit of like a mentality shift in terms of breeding. Because usually when you're buying Epistos, I would say you're probably not going to have raised Fry within 3 months.
Not even close.
Yeah. So like, you still got to get through that juvenile period, no matter if you buy a pair or you buy six. So sort of see that as part of the process. You've got all these fish in there and it'll probably be 6 months, maybe. I mean, enjoy that stage of it as much as the rest.
I tell people that it is normal for them to fail the first four or five spawns. When they come, and so when people come in and they're like, they've spawned twice and they both times they failed. My response is, come back when they fail the sixth time.
Yeah. Then it's time to start looking at swapping things around a little bit.
Because they're just inexperienced. They haven't quite figured out their dynamic yet. That's like, they got to figure it out.
Yeah.
Because anyone listening who's a parent has to know that there is a steep learning curve there.
It takes a long time to learn not to eat your babies. So. Got to really fight that instinct.
This is getting really hard.
But they're usually juveniles anyway, so it's babies raising babies. You got to be like, all right, guys, you can do this.
Right.
Yeah.
So what are some of the, let's talk about some of the generalities of Episto care. The main question everybody comes in and asks is, what size tank? So I know breeders that do them in tens. I think for the average hobbyist, that's too small. But I think there's ways to do it in tens. One of the fun things to look at is, what does an Episto ecosystem in the wild look like? And you referenced Ted Judy. Ted Judy was talking about when he was in Peru collecting Epistos. He was in 3 inches of water with 6 layers of leaves. And you could walk across it and barely get your feet wet because the leaves would just compress. And the groups of Epistos were living in there. So to do a pair of Epistos in a 10-gallon tank, you need to just jam it full of stuff.
Yeah, this is actually really cool. So I generally like the footprint of like a 15 for a lot of Epistos. I just think it gives you, it's better. But I was reading an article of a breeder in Germany that he had written where he breeds almost all of his Epistos in 8-gallon tanks. And so what he does is they're 24 by 12 and they're like 6 inches high.
Oh, right.
Oh, cool.
Because he figured out, I don't know if he did, but he somewhere along the way got the piece of information that male Epistos territory is determined by high in the water column they can get. So that they can have a higher line of sight.
Right.
So if you shorten the water level, their defendable territory just whoosh, so he keeps trios in 8-gallon tanks.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, it's an totally important point because the distinction here is not about gallonage. Mm-hmm. Like, it's about space.
Yeah.
And that's plenty of space. I think gallons becomes an issue when you start adding other fish. And that's when I'm like, okay, well, maybe a 15 or 20 is going to be better if you're going to have a dither species. But like, in terms of how easy they are to maintain water quality for a pair, 8 gallons is just fine.
Yeah. Today, though, if somebody would come in and say, all right, I want the perfect Episto breeding tank, I would say a 20 long.
Yeah.
It definitely gives you more options.
Mm-hmm. And then if you've got parents that need to work some stuff out, there's corners they can get to without
where he can't see her, like, or she can't see him. That's the main thing. Like, even if they go up into the water column, they can't see each other because you've ideally got it jammed with stuff, and then your little group of pencil fish or something like that has plenty of room to also get away if they need to as well.
Glad you brought up pencil fish. That's another good point about a pisto breeding in taller tanks. And I wonder, this is theory at this point, if it's a really short tank, do you need the dither fish?
He doesn't use dithers.
Right. In a taller tank where there's a water column they can swim up to, are the dithers more important? I wonder.
An empty water column looks pretty scary.
It does. Yeah. But if there's no empty water column, there's no room for predators.
Right. You know,
the classic definition, the way we would describe what a dither fish is a group of fish added to a tank to distract either from aggression or predation. So, hey, if those guys are swimming around, it must be okay for me to swim around too.
Yeah. And pencil fish do make a really good one.
They do.
Yeah, and they're pretty robust. They have small mouths, so they're not good at picking off a pisto fry.
Right.
Which even something like, I think, a cardinal tetra is more than capable of doing. And they're also fairly robust in that, like, they can take a swipe here and there and be like, meh.
They've got a tough skin.
Yeah.
Yeah. Literally, not figuratively.
Yep.
Yeah. Those little fish are kind of tanks, too. Like, if you got... I mean, water quality issues, and I don't know. Can we generalize this much here? Pencil fish?
I've had the coral reds, the purples, and the brown pencil fish, and I've had no problems with any of them with anything I do with them.
So water quality issues, little spike because your bio load jumps up twice as much when you've got 20 more babies in there and you're feeding for them. They're just not fussy. They're perfect for a tank like this.
Yep.
Plenty of other fish do it well, but I think pencil fish do it best.
It's the classic dither, and I think for a pisto dither, and I think for a good reason.
Yeah, do we want to rattle off some other options just so we've got, like, basically what kind of fish can go with a pistos?
Just about any group of mild, small fish that aren't too... No, they can even be picky. Any group of mild, small fish that are easy feeders...
Mm-hmm.
I've seen people use endlers. I've seen people use wild type guppies. I don't think the fancy guppies would be a good choice. I think that big flag tail would be too much of a temptation for.
And they're so rambunctious. You don't want anything that's going to like dive down and be stealing food and all that. Mm-hmm. And guppies are not polite.
No, they're not.
Even small wild bettas, I would say, are a good... If we're talking about a display, not necessarily for a breeding setup, there are plenty of other fish you wouldn't want to introduce if you're specifically working on breeding that would be just fine in a display that has them.
Right.
So, now, like, we got that trifasciata pair in the ellipse with a group of Choperae danios.
That is a really good combination.
As long as you're not trying to get... Yeah, as long as you're not trying to get fry.
Right. Right.
Ooh, somebody wants to know if discus are appropriate.
Ooh, that's one of my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
So discus with apistos. I actually really like that combination. It's controversial that I bring that up. In the right kind of tank, I think it works really, really well. And 75 to 90 gallons, big enough where the apistos can have their little spot on the bottom and the discus can have in the top. Very, very well planted, I think, is an absolute necessity to do discus with a pair of pistos. I think just a pair, the discus still, I think, need to be the focus for the aquarium. Everything needs to be centered around the discus. Most of the pistos can handle the high temperatures that discus need.
Disco fish.
Disco.
We both giggled at that whole bit.
This is live, isn't it?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Dang. Anyway, yes. But yeah, so the answer that I would say that, yes, absolutely, a pistos.
It's almost kind of a similar personality. Appreciate the input from the audience. Here.
But you do, I think you would have to carefully select which a pisto.
Yeah, cockatoides, I think, actually would be a fine choice.
Yeah, because you definitely want to avoid, like, there are some in the Reaganite complex group that definitely come from cooler water habitats that I would be a little uncomfortable doing that with. But again, we're trying to generalize a group of like 400 plus fishes. So yes, there are pistos out there you can keep with discus.
Yeah. Densely planted, lots of places to provide cover. And that's not lots of places to hide so much as it is to break up territories.
Feeding would have to be done carefully. Like, you'd have to, I mean, you always have to with a discus tank anyway, but they're like, you don't want to have them have to like come battle through a giant group of discus to try and get food. You're probably gonna have to target feed them.
Yeah, that's probably true. Yeah. A turkey baster to get the food down to the bottom.
That's a good idea anyway.
Yeah. I love, we've done it a couple of times here at the shop, and I love a pair of dwarf cichlids down in the bottom of a discus tank. I think
it works really cool. It's beautiful.
We've done it with Nanochromis, and I think they work great. Mm-hmm. We've done it with Opistos, and I think you could do it with rams as well.
We've done it a few times. That's actually my personal favorite combo, just because I think they handle the higher temperature better than most Opistos, but especially because if you get like a nice German blue, and we often get a lot of warm colored discus, that combo is just nice.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And then the opposite with like a bright orange super red cockatioides and like the cool colors of discus would also be really cool.
That works for me too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a great combination. Mm-hmm.
All right, so compatibility. We got tank size. What about, I mean, equipment isn't going to be too crucial.
So one thing I think to avoid, so some generalities I think that we can talk about. One of the books, this one, going through, talked about this pisto needs a pH of 4.5 and exceptionally soft water. This pisto can go up to 7.2, right? And there was some variation there. This one put most of, I'm sorry, I had that backwards. This is the one that had some really low pHs. This one, when it talked about breeding, most of the breeding, they were doing it just in neutral water. Softer water is where they come from, but there seems to be a lot of evidence for the fact that it's not absolutely necessary. Hard water, that's a problem. So
Like ours.
But with very little manipulation to it, I think that you can do fine with certainly with keeping most of the opistos that are available.
Yeah,
when
I don't
get into breeding. You might need to play with it a little bit.
I don't think we've ever had an issue where we're like, man, we just cannot keep this species of episto alive.
No,
I don't even think that it's common for us to lose an episto.
No, I think if you're just displaying them, the water we have here in Grand Rapids is just fine. Yeah. I think with a lot of Opisto species, and I mean, when I say a lot, I mean a lot. Yeah. I think you could get away with doing like 50% RO, 50% tap water, and that might get you where you need to be.
For breeding. Yeah.
My experience has been is that they are not that picky. No.
So for keeping, keep things out of there that are going to buffer the water, right?
Holy rock
and lace rock, and even be a little cautious with Siriu stone, because that can do a little bit of it. A very inert substrate like a silica sand, or the kind of substrate you'd put in a planet aquarium.
By the way, sand is their favorite because they do like to root around in it a little bit, because they're an invert predator, and where do inverts like to hang out? In the dirt.
The sand.
And the sand.
I would almost think driftwood is a necessary part of an Opisto tank.
Yeah, I was going to say driftwood heavy.
Yeah.
I just don't think they look right without driftwood.
It's like, true. Like, if you saw one in a really like rock heavy aquascape or something like that, it would look a little bit off.
Right.
I would have to get used to it. I think I could.
The effect the wood has on the water, though, puts a little bit of tannins in there. It softens a little bit.
It's good for the skin.
Good for the Opisto skin, too.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I would almost consider that to be essential equipment for an Opisto tank.
Yeah, and we could just say like organics heavy in general. It's a great fish for like any sort of biotope, or like at least mimicking a natural environment setup, because it's an easy environment to recreate, and it looks pretty, and it shows the fish off the way that they would be shown off in the wild.
Sand, driftwood, leaves.
Yeah, it's pretty much that simple, and it will look really cool.
Yeah.
I also think that they can be added to many to most average good planet aquariums out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably.
I put some disclaimers in there, right? We're not talking about, hey, I have a live plant in my aquarium. That means I can do opistos. Maybe it does, but I'm not saying that specifically. But if you are doing, like, I'm going for a really cool aquascape, I'm going to have my school of fish that complement the aquascape, I think a lot of those tanks can handle a pair of opistos.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's magnificent.
Like, you should definitely have a pair of dwarf cichlids in that tank. Whether it's a pair of opistos can be argued, but it probably should be.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know. There are just so many options to go with. Like, I think a lot of people go with cockatoides because they know it's there.
Right.
But I'm also like, Trifasciata, Panduro, those are all readily available and they're all gorgeous.
The cockatoides is the fish that people seem to be working with on a very regular basis.
And it's a fish that you notice from across the room. I mean, if those fins, like, and we're talking specifically, cockatoides is definitely popular, but the specific captive bred variants of cockatoides that have come out are way popular. Like, right. The last year they've exploded in a way that is insane. Like, I remember trying to explain to hobbyists what apistos were 2 or 3 years ago, and like, I've been asked for that fish probably at least 10 times this year.
Yeah.
In terms of breeding, I think the captive bred are probably the more likely to be able to breed in like a hard water setup.
Yeah.
They're going to be more adapted. And you know, we learned that with discus and we learned that with angels.
Yeah. So that's a great place to start if breeding is your goal. But I don't think you should shy away from just choosing the one you want to. It's like we said, it's not that difficult to get it where it needs to be.
Yeah. Just a little finagling.
Right. Oh, yeah. I think an important thing to mention with apistos is current. Most of the apistos come from very slow moving rivers.
Yeah.
So that means the water is turning over on a regular basis. It's not stagnant, but it's not flowing hard. So soft, gentle currents, gentle filtration.
I did have one topic I wanted to talk about with the pistos, because I approached this topic deciding that I wanted to assume that there would be people listening that can't come to our store.
Right.
So the fun thing about apistos here is that they've been through our quarantine process and I do all this for you.
Right.
So then I wrote this entire part of my notes right here is answering the question. I want to work with a wild apisto. How do get it through quarantine?
Perfect.
And so I wanted to start off with saying, this is related to the genetics of captive populations. I think we need more people that need to be brave or eventually graduate from captive bred stock to wild stock, because the availability is there. I think we need to encourage people that are harvesting in these areas to do so. And it's just good for the captive population to have new genetics coming in. So that's my pitch for, you should try it. And this is how you work with them.
If you're going to bring that up, though, you have to bring up, pay attention to collection locations.
Yes.
If you're introducing wild broodstock to captive broodstock, you want to know.
If you can get that information, that's good. But I will also throw out that like there isn't a collection location for super red apistos. So if you're just trying to outcross with that, okay.
All right. I see what you're saying.
You know.
That's a good point. Yeah.
But your distinction is more like, hey, if you're doing Apistogramma agassizii flamenco or Teffe, you should definitely know the difference because it matters.
That matters.
Yeah. That matters a lot. Yeah.
So the first thing to keep in mind with wild caught apistos is they are not fed in transit.
Right.
It's kind of actually dangerous to ship fish with food in their digestive tract. Because that it will definitely lead to an ammonia spike in the bag. So your first hurdle is you need to get that fish feeding on something. And I actually did two different rankings, and that's why I keep looking down, because I can't rattle this off the top of my head. So I did one list of, I think, easiest to lowest of getting them to eat it off the bat.
Oh, yeah.
And then a list of probably best to least nutritious, or at least best options to get them feeding long term.
Oh, perfect.
So the ease list is live foods, frozen foods, pellet foods, gel foods, flakes.
I think that makes sense. It's pretty easy to get them to eat something live.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So right off the bat, I'm going to say, if they don't show symptoms of any particular ailment off the bat, just focus on getting them feeding for the time being.
Right.
Because that is going to be the most important thing.
Get some food in that gut.
Yep. You need them to put on weight.
Even if they are diseased or have internal parasites or whatever, unless you get them eating, you can't fix it.
Yep. You got to get them eating.
Yeah.
So live foods, like if you've got almost any Episto will take live baby brine shrimp.
Right.
Of any size.
Right. And once you get them to take that first bite in captivity, it's so much easier to get them to take that second one, even if it's not the same food.
Yep. Frozen foods I would highly recommend. Bloodworms, brine shrimp, mysis.
I love frozen Daphnia.
Yep.
So I don't do live foods. If the only way you're going to keep this fish alive is to feed it live food, I'm going to complain about watching the fish starve to death, because it's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
Right? I have learned that about myself. I have tried it. You can tell me all of the arguments about how much better it is, blah, 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 yada, yada. And I won't disagree with a single word of it, but I'm still not going to do it.
Yep.
I have been extremely successful with just about any fish that wasn't eating with a small mouth, anything with a small mouth, that feed it some mysis, feed it some flake, feed it some brine shrimp. It's just not eating frozen Daphnia. And that just works.
Sorry, part of our studio audience wants to peace out.
All right. Back to talking about foods and feeding.
Yeah. For
particularly newly introduced, but I think this applies to foods and feeding for Epistos in general.
Yeah.
Yeah, the live food stage is probably going to scare a lot of people off. It's not...
For me, would be a last ditch, like panic, right. Like I can't get them eating anything else.
Yeah, and for specifically wild imports, the stuff that we're getting in is usually coming in eating okay pretty soon.
Yeah, I get them onto frozen foods pretty quick.
Here's my little plug for the Moena, though, because the Moena culture, are you going to go into those?
I was, but I'd go for it, man. Okay,
so the one live food that I would try, because we have it readily available here, and that's the only reason why, is Moena, which Moena is kind of like a small Daphnia, very similar. And for a fish that sees that little Moena trucking around in there, that's like crack. They can't avoid that feeding response.
I gotta have that.
Look at it move. I gotta eat it, right? And so if you get them to take one or two of those little Moenas, and then you introduce frozen Daphnia along with those, it looks like the same thing. So I can see that as being super effective.
Yeah, I'll show those live here. If you want some, come and get them.
Yep. There we go. There's the plug from Moena.
So when I did the ease of feeding, then I'm going to do like what should be your long-term solutions. Mm-hmm. I did put live at the top of the list, not because I think should.
That's a terrible long-term solution.
No, I didn't think that most people should, but I know if Mike Helwig ever hears this and I didn't put that there, he will haunt me forever.
Yep.
The real answer is gel foods. Because the nice thing about Epistos is they do have kind of almost a grazing like feeding habit. So if you get like a little bit of gel food and set it at the bottom of the tank, they will throughout the day eat it. And I really like that strategy with them, because that means that they're getting nutrition in their system in when they want it basis, not on your time. And I think that's just a little bit more like everyone likes being able to choose when they can eat.
Anytime there's food.
Yeah. But then I did frozen pellets and then flakes. Flakes are, I don't think they're a great option for Epistos, just because they're kind of messy and they don't really, like some of the cockatoides will go up to the top, but most don't like picking things off the surface.
It's such a general food too.
And yeah.
Epistos are a little bit more specialized. So they, if you do get one eating flake food, it'll do fine on it, but it's not, I don't think it's optimum.
But frozen foods and a good, like if you were doing, I think most people, the best solution if you're trying to breed long-term would be a good pellet food and treats of frozen foods.
Yeah, I like that.
Because the nice thing about pellet foods is they'll sink and kind of get in the water column. And even when they hit the bottom, they'll eat it. But I think that just like a pellet shape is just buggy enough that they're like, meh.
What about bug bites?
I love bug bites.
Bug bites. We love bug bites here.
Yep. Pretty much everything loves them.
The new Fluval bug bite stuff that
It's amazing.
Oh, yeah.
The slow sinking on those is really encouraging to a lot of fish like Opisthos. Like, they get to watch it for a long time before it gets down to where they want to get it. And by that time, they're like, give it to me, give it to me. Yeah. Pellets are also, like, there's so little guesswork in it. If you're doing frozen foods, you still kind of gotta be like, okay, like, let's weigh the protein versus the fat of this one. Mm-hmm. Let's weigh out that one. Pellets are the dog kibbles of the fish world. They've got the stuff in it in pretty much the right proportions, especially if you're doing something like a bug bite, which
you need
Opisthos eat bugs.
You need a good pellet food, though. Yeah. Don't just pick any pellet food, right? Because there are good dog foods and there are bad dog foods out there, and it's the same thing with fish food.
Yep.
But a complete diet that doesn't have a lot of guesswork in it is definitely something that's desirable to me.
Yeah. And then I want to just throw out there that a lot of people, and this isn't just to Opisthos, this is to fish in general, they'll be like, but my fish won't eat anything else. I can only get it to feed X. Okay, well, getting things to eat other foods might require fasting, and you have to commit to it. Like, having them wait a few days, because if they figure out that if they hold out and you'll give them the good stuff, they'll make you do it.
Anybody who knows Splash completely understands this concept.
Yes.
Oh, that dog.
Oh, I could go into details about that, but...
Look, it was a recent conversation I had with, like, this particularly with a lionfish that made me want to put this here.
Right.
Where it's like, well, he won't take frozen food.
Yes, he will.
Yes, he will.
He will only eat goldfish.
Okay, well, don't feed him goldfish for a few days and then see what he does.
A few days, my fish will starve. The amount of times that we hear that is just... So, okay, fish are not people and they're not puppies. There's nobody in the wild going, hey, let's throw some food in because these fish look hungry.
They're not even mammals. Newsflash.
Right.
Yeah. As large-bodied mammals, we're terrible at guessing what fish need to eat. Fish can easily go 2 or 3 weeks in the wild without a meal.
Easily.
And so my genuine response a lot of time to it's, won't they starve, is, well, most of the fish I keep at home, I'm trying to breed. So I think that my fish should get fed more than most people displaying their fish should.
Right.
I have cats. So whoever's taking care of the cats when I'm on vacation, if I'm gone for less than 7 days, they're being told, don't you dare touch my tanks.
Don't feed them.
Because the risk of them overfeeding and doing something bad to the tank is far greater than any risk that my fish will, quote unquote, suffer from not eating for a few days.
One of my favorite phrases is that begging fish are healthy fish, not hungry fish.
Yes.
The amount of times I get people saying, oh, my fish, they're just up at the surface frantically trying to get food because they're starving.
Yeah, what am I supposed to do, not feed them?
Correct. It's the Midwest. You know, it's heroic to overeat here. That's what you do. There's a problem. You throw food at it. That doesn't apply to fish. That doesn't apply to Opisthos. I know I'm going down a tangent here about overfeeding.
This tangent belonged here, though.
This tangent belongs in all kinds of places.
Well, and you're so working against yourself if by trying to get this sensitive fish healthy, you poison the water and kill it.
Right.
Like, you just want to throw, like... You get so nervous. You want to put everything at it. You want to give it its best chance. You spent more than you should have maybe on this fish, you know? It's that fish for you.
Yeah.
And you just want to give it everything. And you got to stop. Like, you got to be patient. You got to understand that no matter how much food you throw in there, babies aren't hatching tomorrow.
Right. Like,
and nothing, you can't do anything to change the timeline that those fish are on.
If you want to know whether or not your fish is hungry, it has almost nothing to do with behavior. It has to do with the appearance of the fish. If the belly's looking a little sunken in, if the around the dorsal fin it's looking a little sunken in, that's a starving fish. That's an underfed fish. Or a fish that has some kind of a digestive
issue. If you feed daily and you see that, don't feed more.
Right. Something's wrong. If your fish looks round, if the belly area looks flat or slightly convex, your fish is not starving no matter what its behavior is.
Mm-hmm.
Those are good contours.
Right. That's mm-hmm. That's normal. Look at pictures of fish. If your fish looks like that picture, it's not starving.
Yeah, it's that simple.
I don't know how long we could go on this topic.
We could go on for, but it's really relevant in a breeding discussion in a sensitive fish discussion. Yeah.
It's insensitive fish overeat.
Yeah.
Or overfed. It's
Yeah.
It's by far the most right? common problem we've come across, though.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
How and that's not just exclusive. I want to, anyone listening, this is not exclusive to freshwater people, by the way. This is in the hobby as a whole. This is the most common problem is overfeeding.
Right. Yep. Okay, anyway. We digressed. We went down that.
All right.
Down that
so feeding, bucket. We covered pretty well.
I'm still not done.
Oh, we're not done. Okay, I'm sorry. Done.
But feeding, you got it eating now.
Okay.
It's a wild fish.
Right.
Probably got parasites.
Probably does.
Now you worry about that.
Yeah.
So the first problem you're probably going to see is assuming you don't see symptoms of anything else, almost definitely has internal parasites.
Probably.
So our preferred medication for that here is Prezipro.
Fantastic medication.
That stuff is amazing.
By Hikari.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. It's made my life so much easier. I'm not even going to make other recommendations just because I'm like, no, that's really the one
just
you should use.
Prezipro.
Yeah. Right. Anything else shows external symptoms. And by the time they get to you, the stress, the lack of food, they're pretty weak overall. Like their immune systems are not working top notch. So any diseases that would show up on the surface, which is basically anything other than internal parasites, probably will show up pretty soon after shipment. So just treat for the only one that you can't see if you can't see anything.
Yeah. And I was going to mention most of the other diseases, I feel like most people can figure out how to treat ick. That's pretty real. Like that's all over. But I was reading a lot of Ted Judy stuff and he mentioned that he occasionally sees gill parasites. Mm. And so I wanted to mention that he uses a malachite green and formalin combination.
Okay.
Okay.
So, I would say look into that. specifically try to find anything by Ted Judy talking about that because that seems to be his preferred. And if you're wondering why I keep bringing him up, for me, he is the person that I like to defer to for captive breeding of pistos and working with him because he's cool.
He's done a lot with importing too, and that's a lot of a charm. Malachite green and formalin, a lot of the traditional medications for treating ick contain one or both of those ingredients. So if you don't want to get to the scary dealing with formalin, sometimes some of the stronger ick medications will have that in anyway and will treat some of the gill parasites as well.
Yeah, so I just wanted to throw that one out there just because I'm like, I don't want to scare anyone, but I also want you to know that if you see it, there are resources out there and you can fix it.
Right. Yeah, it's a harsher treatment, so I wouldn't recommend just like going for that, but like it will take care of.
The Prezipro, I would say if you got wild caught ones and you didn't get them from somewhere that did it for you, go ahead.
Yeah.
Anything else, treat as you see it, as need.
Right. And kick that temperature up.
Yeah.
That's one of the really good tricks with imported fish is a lot of these fish come from waters that sometimes get close to 90 degrees. Now that's not necessarily going to be their standard, let's keep this fish at 90, but they can handle a little bit of time up around 90. A lot of the parasites can't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So keeping that fish around 90 for a little while and then bringing it back down, oxygenation is key.
Yeah.
But getting them up that hot, that can take care of a lot of the parasites, internal and external.
Yeah, no. That method does not work for all fish.
No,
this
not at all.
Specifically.
No. Yeah.
A lot of people want to just like crank up the heat on anything, anytime they see any disease. And like, that doesn't treat everything for everything.
Yeah.
And this specific case, it's perfect.
Personally, I don't consider bumping up heat as a treatment. I would consider it alongside with a treatment because it definitely makes treatments more effective. Mm-hmm. Because bumping up the temperature, what it does in most cases is speed up the life cycle of the parasite. Right. So that means you can eradicate it faster when in tandem with treating it with a medication. But personally, and this is me on my, I'm going to die on this hill kind of thing where I'm being very clear. This is my, I skew on one side of the spectrum here. I don't consider it a treatment. but I do consider it a auxiliary. It's like the chicken noodle soup alongside actual medication in my mind.
I don't think it's a treatment at 85, but near 90, I think it treats a lot of stuff.
I do too. Yeah, I do too. But that's just making sure everyone listening understands everyone at this table doesn't always agree. Yeah. And that's part of this hobby.
I think what we can all agree on, though, is if you do have an issue, getting the temperature a little bit above normal for the fish, i.e. 78 to 80 is a typical temperature for keeping many to most of the tropical fish that we keep. Bumping that up to 85 for a little while will help with whatever medications you're using.
Yep.
There are circumstances where I say bump it up to 90, sometimes even 95 for certain fish. Mm-hmm. Other people disagree, and I totally recognize that. But I do think, you know, maybe I'll even say it this way to nudge slightly in Charles' direction even more, that if you are treating with some of the commercially available medications and bumping the temperature up a little bit, you are safely going to solve almost all of those issues. Bumping up to 95, it's a little bit riskier.
Yeah.
But it's doing it without chemicals.
That's the trade-off you're making.
Then. That is. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yep. Cool.
So anyways, I really wanted to get that topic out there.
Yeah. When we do our discus talk, I'll tell you a fun Ted Judy story about discus in 95 degrees. But that's there's a teaser for when we do our discus.
There we go.
That's a story for another podcast.
There we go. All right. So what's the perfect Episto tank?
A 20-gallon with a ton of driftwood and leaves in it.
I would say a 40-gallon breeder so that I can have like a male and like four females.
Mm.
Just because I really love watching the dynamic of like the females don't always get along. So they're squabbling over, this is my area for raising children. And the male's just kind of like doing his thing. Like, I am so cool. I'm protecting everyone. Like
that behavior is really cool to watch.
Yeah. It's so much fun to watch.
Especially when he gets too close to the female and the female's like, ah, not your job, buddy. Back off.
Get on your side of the table.
Amy, what's your favorite Episto?
I think trifasciata probably.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think so.
I can't be mad at that choice.
No, it's hard to choose, but I do love anybody who's got the little mohawk. Elizabethae, maybe?
That bright orange tail is so cool.
Yeah, and I really love Banshee, but for the females.
The females in that one, I would definitely argue, are better than the males.
And the males are ridiculously gorgeous, so it's like there's no wrong answer there, but like the females of Banshee are particularly spectacular.
See, that's kind of why I like the females of Nisenai's. And that's the Nisenai, the shape of the Nisenai, that really Nisenai and Pandora, which some people are describing as the same thing, some as a subspecies, you know, all kinds of different things going on. But anyway, I'm going to talk about it as Nisenai. That really cool little red edge on the tail.
Oh, it's so pretty.
And to me, that's the female. That the bright yellow with the dark black, very distinct pattern.
And together they have that like primary color, red, yellow, blue, because the male gets that blue sheen too.
Yep.
And if you were really lucky, you'll sometimes get a male that's almost a little like lavendery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, there will be a pair of those up here.
Somewhere.
Yeah. What about you, Charles?
The Agassiz eyes are my personal favorite.
That's cheating. You're going to have to be more specific.
Let's say Agassiz flamenco.
Okay.
You'll notice I picked a color variety and not a location.
I'm surprised.
Man, that like a good flamenco male has like that green face and then it turns to blue and then the tail is yellow.
They're amazing.
They're amazing.
That orangish yellow color is a really unique, like.
And there is a color variety of Agassizii that I have never seen that I know I've shown you photos of, and I'm suddenly blanking on what it's called.
I can't remember now.
But, oh man, that's. Anyways, for me, Agassizii, the big selling point for it is its profile. Like that spade shaped tail and everything, you will not mistake that for anything else from across the room.
There's a reason that Aquarium Rush uses a Agassizii as one of its iconic symbols. Mm-hmm. Yep. I You know that you guys are not wrong for making those your favorites.
You know, you weren't wrong either.
I appreciate that. That's definitely one of those that you're just not. Like you're missing something if you don't think mine's better. But those. No,
if somebody would say Borelli, I would say yup. If somebody would say Hongsloy, I would say yeah, definitely.
And here's the beauty, and I was really hoping this would come up. Here's the beauty of the Pistos, because when we talk Bettas, we have very strong camps here in the store of like. That's your favorite? Come on.
Yeah. Right.
Those are brown.
But with Apistos, there is no wrong answer, no matter who you are.
Good.
Well, you know, the boring one.
Which one?
There is no boring one.
There's not.
No.
Even the cute little Pibas.
The color.
That male is an emerald color now.
Yeah. He's so pretty. And they're so little. That pair's been here too long. Somebody come get that Pibas pair.
That's right.
Yeah, that's an underrated Apisto.
So what did we miss talking about Apistos? I mean, we could go on for hours and hours and hours.
Mm-hmm. If you're watching this on Facebook after we've already ended, or if you're listening to this podcast when we post it in a couple weeks, I want to hear what your favorite Apisto is, so let us know. You can either comment that on Facebook or send an email to podcast@watercolorsaquariumgallery.com, and I would love to hear about it.
If you have questions about keeping the right Apisto or the right conditions to keep an Apisto in, hey, is this okay for my Apistos? Can I do this? Let us know. Reach out on Facebook. Come on into the gallery and talk to us about it here.
Yeah, I never get sick of those conversations.
No, we love talking Apistos.
So you guys got Apistos?
Yeah.
No, that'll never happen.
The reaction, because so many places don't carry them and I don't get it.
We usually have at least 6 species.
I know.
Not 10.
And people will come in and be like, do you have Apistos? And I'm like, oh, what are you looking for? And they look at me like, well, what do you mean? Just do you have them? I've got many. One do you want?
Yeah. There's a reason that us fish geeks get so excited about this fish. And I think it's because the people that are into fish because of their behavior. Hey, you should try an Apisto. The people that are into fish because of their color. Hey, you should try an Apisto. The people that are into fish because they just want something extra for their tank. Hey, you should try an Apisto.
The breeders, the ones who are just keeping a single display, the planted tank people who need a bright contrast. It's like everyone's got room for one.
I'm glad you mentioned breeders too, because there are some of them that are easy, cockatoides, right? And there are some of them that, you really gotta have your stuff together to do this. You can do it, but it's not like, put a pair together. Boom, look, I got babies.
You could dedicate your entire hobby to breeding Apistos, and you would never run out of things to do.
And you'd never get bored.
No.
And we'd love to hear about it if you do.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
If you have video, I want to see it.
Right. Well, anybody out there who's still watching, thank you for watching. Anybody out there listening, thank you very much for listening. We very much appreciate it. Check us out on YouTube. We'll do some little YouTube videos about some Apisto complexes. Mm-hmm. Or groups, or clads, or lineages.
Or lineages.
Or maybe just a species or two.
We definitely did a Master Eye one, so check that out.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you very much for listening. Let's have lots of fun and keep those hands wet.